Wednesdays at this time, Anna DeVlantis joins us for This Week in Chicago History. And
good morning, Bob.
Morning. Let's start by going back to November of 1962, the Rat Pack in the suburbs.
Okay, so wondering how many of your listeners knew about this, Bob, 1962, or have heard about this. For 1 week and 1 week only, the Rat Pack took residence as the house band for a restaurant in Wheeling, Illinois. And I mean the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. The restaurant was called the Villa Venice, and it was no ordinary Italian restaurant. There were like these gondola rides that would, they had this man-made river, and they take the diners to the establishment, and there were Vegas-style, scantily clad women in headdresses who would perform regularly inside this club. It was owned somewhat secretly, Bob, by Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana, and there was an illegal gambling operation said to operate out of Villa Venice. It looked a lot like, from the outside, a regular Italian restaurant, but it didn't have a lot of windows, Bob, if you know what I mean. They didn't really want you to know what was going on inside of this place. But the backstory on how the Rat Pack came to perform there is that it was believed to be payback, to Giancana, maybe for his assistance in turning out the union vote for President Kennedy, who Frank Sinatra was close with. Others speculate that it was a friendly gesture to keep the mob boss happy for other reasons. Whatever it was, the Rat Pack performed like 7 or 8 nights in a row. Never got paid for it, by the way, at the Villa Venice in Wheeling, Illinois.
Imagine that, an illegal gambling operation run out of the place.
A mob joint.
Yeah.
Right. I can't imagine what else. So we'll just leave it there.
Yeah. The Villa Venice, part of Chicago history. Back to 1994 now for a Hoop Dreams and the premiere.
Can you believe it's 30 years, Bob? I'm sure you've seen Hoop Dreams.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great.
Started out as a local project, a small production company locally. They wanted to do a 30-minute doc about the path of two inner-city Chicago eighth graders with dreams of making it to the NBA. It grew into a critically acclaimed, globally distributed, award-winning documentary. Not just a PBS thing that they thought it was going to be. They ended up, though they thought they were going to follow them for a year, they followed these two young men for 6 years and really dug into the hard lives they had and the challenges of making their dreams come true and the odds of making it and the extreme pressure on them. Just crazy. It just crazy difficult odds and the interactions with everyone around them who were either trying to make it happen or standing in the way and just a very real and moving documentary that became such a topic of discussion, you know, across America and really made it around the world too about what it was like, this journey. It has got the number one ranking on 50 documentaries to see before you die. The film was selected for presentation in the U.S. By the National U.S. Film Registry, by the Library of Congress. We pulled the original review, Bob, I think you'll like this, from Siskel and Ebert when Hoop Dreams was released nationwide.
Hoop Dreams is one of those rare film experiences where you simply forget yourself and sit there totally involved in the incredible drama of what's happening. You may think you don't want to see a film about the inner city or about basketball, or you don't want to see a 3-hour documentary about anything. But please forget those preconceptions. Hoop Dreams is a great film, and you owe it to yourself to see it.
Oh, I think it's wonderful, as we've talked about earlier this year. And what I love is, and we must remember, the filmmakers who had this idea. And I love when filmmakers have the courage to say, you know what? We're going to spend a whole bunch of time tracking people's lives. Mm-hmm. Here, we're following kids for 6 years. And of course, their lives are full of drama.
What's remarkable, they started out to make a 30-minute documentary about these eighth graders, and they realized, no, we're stuck with these guys for the long run, and they made 250 hours of film.
And it all started out as a little local production, didn't it?
Yeah, how about that? Really a really cool story. And worth seeing again.
Yeah, oh, definitely. This week in 1984, Phil Donahue made a big move, and we lost him here, didn't we?
We lost him from Chicago. He was the king of daytime talk at this moment in time, 1984, Bob. Phil Donahue had his TV talk show based right in the WGN TV studios. And in 1974, he launched it. 10 years he was there, Bob, before he decided to move his show and his life to New York. And it was such a ratings success. Phil Donahue always said one of the keys to his success, he credited the Midwestern audience, the Chicago audience, because he said they had such sensible questions and such questions that his audience, his TV audience, really wanted to know that he didn't always think of, that he was one of the first guys to get out there in the audience and run around with the microphone. You know, remember him breathlessly trying to ask people questions. What do you think? Tell us your question. And it really was a part of his success. But this point in time, he decided to make the move. It was a very personal reason behind it. And here he is discussing it with David Letterman.
I get to now actually leave work and go home just like a regular person and live here every week, all week, without getting on an airplane. That's a big, big change in my life. Beyond that, there's a certain amount of creative energy that's, you know, it's like when you start your show, you're a little scared and nervous and everybody works harder. We found that when we moved to Chicago 10 years ago, we got scared. What if they don't like us? And I think as hard as you try, and we have, we're very proud of the fact that we think we've stayed on top of it and stayed hungry. This new move for everybody in the office renews the creative juices, and I think that the show will reflect it. And we also get to deliver the show sooner. In other words, we will use satellites here so that we don't have... Right now, we have some markets that are 5 weeks late, and, you know, it's hard to do topical... We have Lindbergh landing in one of our...
I want to say, is the caller there right now?
Right, is the caller there? Remember that? That's a great line, great line.
You know, I still miss Phil Donahue, who recently passed away. We'll tell you about the weather and the traffic, and then we'll get back to Anna with more This Week in Chicago History. Oh, yeah. Muddy Waters and the Rolling Stones at the Checkerboard Lounge in Chicago. What a night that was, Anna.
What an iconic, legendary performance. So much history steeped into that, Bob. And we owe Muddy Waters credit for inspiring the Rolling Stones so much so they named their band for one of his songs. The whole rock genre, rooted in the blues, of course, and Muddy Waters, the father and godfather of the Chicago blues scene. It was just so happened that Mick Jagger was recording at Chess Records in Chicago when he got a chance to meet one of his musical idols, and they started just jamming a jam session together. Turned into that, you know, meetup at the Checkerboard Lounge, which became a CD and a DVD, and they just really, it just... so magical to see the two of them together, two legends riffing on stage. It was you know, it just it was called the day that rock met its roots, and lots have been written about it and said about it. Just a really cool thing to think that the Chicago blues man Muddy Waters inspired a band like the Rolling Stones. Pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know what? It makes me want to watch it again because it's. I think you can also see it on YouTube, can't you?
Yeah, you can. They just have so much charisma and like so much admiration for each other. They're having fun, right? They're just interacting in two different styles, influencing each other. It is worth going back and checking it out.
All right, now we move to an animal story, and not everybody was happy about this addition to the Lincoln Park Zoo, right?
You know, it kind of seems like Lincoln Park Zoo's always been there, Bob, but over time, these animals were collected, and back in the day, it didn't always go well. 18 sea lions were shipped out this week in 1889, and I pulled... There's an old Tribune story that talks about how Lincoln Park was so crazy. Everybody who lived, the residents, these sea lions were barking all night, incessantly, 24 hours a day. And they wanted to ship them back to the West Coast. They just didn't like these new residents. But apparently it turned out they didn't have the proper space for them. They needed areas to rest outside the water, and they figured this out over time. They didn't want to swim all day. They wanted to chill out, and so they made some adjustments. They actually had one sea lion, a 600-pounder, make his way into Lake Michigan, and they had to go find him. They had all kinds of issues with these sea lions, but eventually figured it out, and you know, one of the favorite parts of going to the zoo to this day is the sea lion exhibit. So
but,
it worked out.
But back in 1889, Lincoln Park Zoo was more of a park, wasn't it, than a zoo?
You know, it's a park, yeah, and then that's how it started. It was, you know, 20 years before, the city was gifted its first animals, two swans from the city of New York. There had been in Paris and in New York, there was a lot of talk about how they had these beautiful parks surrounded by water and these swans, and there was this elegant sophistication to it that Chicago admired. And so New York gifted Chicago, mm-hmm. and that was the beginning of Lincoln Park Zoo.
And finally, we have another example of the great advertising history here in Chicago.
So rich, Bob. You know, Leo Burnett Advertising just created so many iconic brands and brand faces. And who doesn't love the Pillsbury Doughboy, the cute little cuddly guy? He was a creation of Rudy Purz. Purz, his name is. He took home a tube of the dough, and Leo Burnett said, "You go figure out what to do with this oozy gooey dough and come up with a character to represent the brand." And the Pillsbury Doughboy was born. So kind of cool to think about it. Stop motion clay animation is how they did it back in the 60s. Of course, it's changed since then, but we did pull a little bit here, retro, to remind us of the Pillsbury Doughboy story.
Purz took home a cylinder of dough and spent the night contemplating how to market the oozing mix of flour and water.
What would happen if something came out of that tube? It'd be made of dough. What do you call something like that?
And somehow, out popped in his mind, the Doughboy.
And who are you?
I'm Poppin' Fresh, the Pillsbury Doughboy. May I?
The first TV commercials were shot using a stop-motion technique that required 5 Doughboy bodies and 15 heads.
His belly was so prominent, I thought, oh, that's the kind of thing you'd want to... And then he'd giggle, of course.
You know, I was just thinking about Mr. Purr's wife when we brought home a tube of that dough to play around with.
Yeah, what would Marianne do? Throw that out. That's not good for right. you, Bob. Don't eat that.
Yeah, exactly.
Get rid of it.
Yeah, but the Doughboy is still alive and well, isn't he?
Still alive and well. Will appear in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, in fact, this year. So, watch for him.
Thank you. Anna DeVlantis, talk to you next week.
Talk to you then, Bob.